This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is Frida Liu, and I don't know what Monday of the month it is. The third Monday of the month. That's when Shankar Santhiam from EQTD Consulting joins us. Of course, this is our Developing a Personal Growth Culture series. The topic we'll discuss in just a moment because Richard Bradbury is also in the studio.
I am. So we talk about social media a lot, of course, on Enterprise Biz Bytes. And we already know that things like anger and anxiety are used by social media companies to help spread their content. If you're outraged, we know it will spread well. What I'd like to know, though, is because there's been a recent report talking about how 4,000 people were interviewed, and they basically said that they felt extremely manipulated by the algorithms that are used by these social media companies. My question is then, just how manipulated do you feel by these social media algorithms? Mm. Let us know. Get us on Enterprise Biz Bytes on 018-789-8899 at noon. And of course, you can get us on Twitter or on Instagram at BFM Radio.
All right, which sort of links very nicely to what we're talking about. Shankar,
fear.
What fear does to us, right?
Absolutely.
Now, again, as obviously, you know, before we get into that topic, we have to talk about last month.
Because it's only once a month that I see you, Frida. I mean, so people forget what we discussed.
Yeah, we're going to recap all of it. So lesson 10. Chapter 10 of the next book, I Know How It Works, was Get Connected to Why You Work. So, key points, brief key points.
Brief, when have I ever been brief? When you get connected to the reality of that you come to work for your lifestyle choices, what you find is that you live differently. At work. That is essentially what we talked about the last time, which is many people find it so that there's this inability to connect with why exactly they do what they do. I was talking to my friend recently, who is a psychiatrist, Dr. Philip George.
And, good man.
Very good man. He used to be on BFM before. And he was talking about, he was saying, you know, how's your work going and so on. And coming back to getting connected at work, we were talking about this. And he just gave me a very brief, I'm not a scientist of any stretch of the imagination, neither am I a psychologist. But he gave me a very brief outline. He said, no, you have the limbic brain and you have the neocortex. And he said, you know, if you can get your limbic brain to believe and understand, and some people call it the subconscious mind, to do certain things, then you will find that your life is essentially, for the lack of a better word, controlled by it. And we were talking about bad habits, you know, about things like smoking and, you know, consuming alcohol and in excess and stuff like that. And he said that if you can program the limbic brain to actually connect with the good and the bad and connect with what is the right thing for your body, for example, that will work. And we were just having a chat about this. Now, getting connected to work, literally, you need that purpose drive. If you don't have that purpose drive, you will find that you will be there will be a great inability for most of us to align our attitude. You know, attitude's always at best confrontational, at worst, you know, downright bad. And when we meet colleagues who we deem as having a bad attitude, often you will find that it's essentially because they're completely disconnected with what they do and why they do. See, many of us come to work because we want to show the world that we are right, that we are, you know, clever, that we are better than others, so on and so forth. When in fact you should come to work, as you start off by coming to work, because, you know, we need to generate our lifestyle. Therefore, we have skill sets that can be bartered against the earnings that we have. I mean,
it's for that lifestyle.
Yeah, basic economics. You know what I mean? I need to live a particular lifestyle. I need to fund that lifestyle. One of the best ways for me to do that is leverage on my skills. Now, if you understand that right at the beginning, you come to work every day and say, my sole focus today is to leverage on my skills. And when you leverage on your skills, you must also appreciate that many of us work in groups of people that requires us to inspire and engage other people around us in order for everyone to perform to a point where we all create results for all of us for all our desired needs, wants, and lifestyle choices, so on and so forth. And this comes only when you get connected to work. And if you don't get connected to why you do what you do, and work is one, this can be transliterated to your life, to your partnerships with your parents or with your children or with your spouses, with your partners, so on and so forth. In business, why do you open a particular business? I was coaching someone recently in a new startup, and they were very passionate, but I kept seeing them every maybe 2 to 3 weeks, and I after about 4 or 5 times I said, you know, I think there's a slight disconnect in what you do. And she took a little bit of offense. She said, what do you mean? Why? I said, because I know your business. I think it's a good business. And I agreed to come on to coach you because I think you're doing a good thing for society. But you seem to be going all over the place all the time. And I think essentially, fundamentally, I think you're not connected to why you're doing what you're doing. And that is what we need to focus on. Why? The why is really important. And if you don't get that why, it's very difficult.
It was one of the decisions as well, leaving my previous company to do this. Because the last role I did, I was taking care of business partners. Mm-hmm. And so the why, because it was a lot of chasing numbers, chasing that the money gets through and say, okay, when the business partners get the money, they'll be able to do a better job in their marketing efforts. Mm-hmm. And with their marketing efforts, they'll be able to earn more money buying our equipment. And hence, I was trying to find a connection. Mm-hmm. And after a while, and I also realized that was a very important role, mm-hmm. but that wasn't my skill.
Absolutely.
Right? But I tried to find the higher purpose to it, and I got to the higher purpose, but that was not chasing.
So firstly, you found the higher purpose, which meant that you could go to work every day and do the job because the higher purpose drove you. But in the pursuit of that higher purpose, you also realize what works for you and
it
what doesn't.
Right?
Yeah, which is why you left that and you're now here for 10 years and happy. And obviously much happier because this, what you do here, you're deeply connected to what you do. And there might come a point when you find that this is a disconnect as well. And there's a possibility. And that's why people have many iterations of their life in terms of their work. And they keep changing. You meet people in their 50s and 60s who've now started a new career, for example.
Well, because we evolve. Fungus.
Absolutely.
Fungus also grows, but we're not in a swamp.
But grows in a negative way.
Right?
So we shouldn't be fungi.
We should be blooming. We should be flourishing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this month we'll be discussing a lesson because we could go on with last month.
Yeah, maybe we should do two episodes per lesson now, I think.
Okay.
It's just the rules for me to come back more often. I'm sorry.
Lesson 11. Okay, I like it because lesson 12 is next month and the year. What fear does to us? So what can you tell us about this?
Fear, I think this is something that
feel the fear and do it anyway.
Well, we all confront this all the time. Frida, you speak publicly for a living, not just in the radio station, but you do a lot of events and you speak to large groups of people. I saw a photo of you recently speaking in front of the Prime Minister of Malaysia, which is such an honour. But one of the things that, I teach public speaking as part of the work that I do, or presentation skills, and one of the things the first kind of law of presenting in public, whether it's a group of one, a group of two, or one person, two, or 100 people, or 1,000 people, is to understand and manage fear. And I think once we overcome this, or once we understand this, then, the growth potential grows immensely. If you go back through history, and I remember reading something, when I was when you were at university, you're thrust with all sorts of books and stuff and you also are slightly wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and you think you need to read everything in order to be that clever person that you actually want to be. And I still remember what my first year at university I was reading law. I was in the University of Sussex Library and I picked up, I thought, ooh, Aristotle. I thought, very good. I should be reading this because this will make me clever. Of course, it made me feel really stupid because, I read a few pages and thought what I mean? I just don't get this. But interesting. One of the earliest quotes that stuck in my mind was from Aristotle, who was a philosopher, as we all know, but he was also a great scientist, apparently. Courage is the first of the human virtues because it makes all others possible. I remember this. And I remember this being almost like a standard bearer in my life at that time. I needed to be courageous. And what this did was, as a university student living in England and turning up there, and I remember arriving in England in December of 1988, December 12th, which is deepest, darkest winter. And, you know, I'd never been anywhere cold before in my life. I was 17 years old, 18 years old at the time. Never been anywhere cold. And in like in Malaysia, you know, when the temperature drops down to 29 or 30 degrees, it's a juha.
Yeah.
You know, so all you do is you, for me, it was like, you know, rolling down your long sleeve shirt so that, you know, you became, you know, when you're cold, you do that. In offices, people, you know, people roll down, go, like, oh, sejuk. So I arrived there and, you know, it was like, you know, 5 degrees or 10 degrees and tipping down with rain. And I was there for a week. And I think within that first week, I decided I can't live here anymore. I need to go home. Mm. I need to get back. And I remember speaking to my father about this. And I think one of the greatest pieces of advice, he's given me a lot of advice, some of it unwarranted with my father, but like all fathers. But this was one of those greatest pieces of advice my father gave me. He said, you know, wait for 3 months. Force yourself to stay here for 3 months, and then make a decision. Best 3 months of my life. I never came back, and I stayed on for 6 years in total, went to university, I worked. It really shaped my mind. But the thing that kept me going right at the beginning stage was this phrase that courage is the most important thing that we actually need to develop. And in order for us to develop courage, we must understand. Mm. You know, I don't want to use the word understand because it's very hard to understand fear. It's deep psychological connotations to it. And that's not it. But understand that you will be afraid. That's the first thing, right? They're like, you know, we get, why am I afraid? No, I shouldn't be afraid. So we shun away from it. When in fact you go like, I am afraid and I know I'm going to be afraid. And that's something that is going to come to me. Now, this happens every single time. If you cast your memory back to life in general, it happens at every spot. For example, when you are sitting for your Form 3 examinations, and you and I of a certain age where we remember it being called SRP exams, that was the most difficult exam in front of you that you'd ever done in your life. And you are full of fear. Now, the moment you pass SRP in Form 4, you look back at it and you're like, you immediately go, well, it wasn't difficult. So the next difficult thing was your SPM exams, and that was like be all, end all, life or death, you know, and people apply a tremendous amount of pressure. Kids right now today are sitting for the SPM exams. It's happening as we speak. And there are people who are passing out in the morning before they get to school. And, you know, if any SPM student is listening to this, I want to say, like, dude, there's going to be a lot harder things you're going to do in your life than your SPM exams. So enjoy this.
Right.
And fear allows you to enjoy things.
And I guess, like, you know, as you graduate and, you know, move on in life, you have to climb like new levels of fear and then built on top of that.
And also, you know, Fred, just one last thing before we go, which is this. Nelson Mandela also said in The Long Walk to Freedom, he's, you know, and this is something which has stayed for many, many years in the kind of lexicon of modern literature, which is, he says, I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear.
Mm. All right. So what does fear do to people? We'll discuss that after this with Shankar Santir from EQTD Consulting. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Enterprise and it's Race Your Game, and I'm here with Shankar Santir from EQTD Consulting. Frida Liu here. I started developing a personal growth culture series and what fear does to us. So, you know, we talked a little bit about it briefly, but also, you know, what is this whole thing with fear? What does it do to people?
What does it do? I mean, we've all been fearful. What does it do? Fear can either debilitate or motivate. I think in essence, we can boil it down to these two things. This is what happens to me, and this is what I talk about in my coaching sessions with people. You either get completely debilitated by fear, meaning you find yourself not being able to do certain things. You don't want to attempt certain things. Richard Yates in Revolutionary Road, another great book, said, you know, if you... the best way to not fail is to not try anything. You know, so I'm paraphrasing, but something along those lines, right? So it debilitates. Or it motivates. I also know that for me personally, my fear motivates me to do a range of things, right? From getting up and going out marketing my you know, my wares when I think that, oh, I think I'm not sure where my next paycheck is going to come from, or it's now December and it's a slow month, and if I don't get out this month and go and meet clients and pursue my programs, or for the lack of a better word, sell my programs and my coaching sessions, what's going to happen is in January and February, I'm not going to have any money. And not having any money in January and February is a fearful place to be in life when you're almost 50 years old, for example. Mm. So now that motivates me. So for some people, fear is a motivational tool. For others, it debilitates. Brene Brown, who authored a best-selling book called Daring Greatly.
Brene Brown.
I don't know how they call it Brene, and some people call it Breen and some call it Brene, but it's B-R-E-N-E.
Brene.
So Brene.
Brene Brown.
Brene Brown, right? Yeah. Yeah. So she, Miss Brown, I think I'll call her that right now.
BB.
BB did a lot of research at the University of Houston. And she says that a lot of us, we, in her research, she said there's a certain feeling of unworthiness that people have, which is what fear does. You don't want to try something. You don't want, I mean, for years, I had to work with my wife. My wife is, as you know, is the only holistic veterinary practitioner in Malaysia. But her life took a very interesting trajectory. She was a conventional veterinarian for some years, well, almost 10 years. Well, no, 14 years. I'm getting all the numbers mixed up right now in my head. She was a conventional veterinary surgeon for 14 years. And then she decided that my true purpose in life, and she did that, you know, research with herself and decided that she needed to move on and do something like this, right? Here, to somewhere else. I want to go into holistic medicine. But when she got into holistic medicine, for example, it became really tough. I still remember 10 years ago, the first kind of, you know, month or two doing it, she didn't want to get up and go to work.
Right.
And I said, but you wanted to do this. But now why do you not want to do it? Because this is I don't know if I'm doing it right. I'm not sure if I can. I don't know if I should. I'm a bit kind of, you know, should I not? So a lot of us have this, which is also why we stop ourselves from doing things. We stop ourselves from progressing, you know. And she also, Miss Brown, in that book talks about vulnerability.
Mm.
And she says that vulnerability is something that we need to show.
Yeah.
And when we accept and we understand that vulnerability is an important integral part of who we are, that helps us come to terms with our fears. Mm. So what does it do for people? People who don't accept their vulnerability don't want to show that. And in real terms, it translates as people who are dysfunctional at work, people who are rude, people who are...
Haughty.
Haughty. And, yeah, haughty. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a very interesting word, isn't it? Haughty.
Yeah.
And people who are combative all the time.
Yeah.
And often you find that, you know, people are... You know,
this need to be right.
Yeah, yeah. The best form of defense is attack, you know. And, and this is something that footballers and basketball players and American football players learn as part of the coaching technique. Now, of course, it works in sport. But when you are fearful, you also sometimes... There are people who actually adopt that particular strategy in life, which is... attack is the best form of defense.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing, right? When you're always that way, your cortisol actually is actually very bad for your health, right? And when she talked about vulnerability, I read that book. It shows strength, right? And if you're trying to, you're not trying to endear to people, but it just gives hope to people that we all have our flaws and there are moments that will frighten us, and that's good.
That is absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. You know, I mean that. Also gives us a sense of authenticity. I mean, we live in a time where we actually respect people who are authentic.
Mm.
I don't want to meet a politician, for example, who I know this is a silly saying and people listening are going to laugh. I don't want a politician who lies to me. Everyone's laughing right now. But literally, I would like a politician. I mean, I have zero problem if the politician tells me or if a minister tells me, I don't know.
Right?
To a question.
I will.
I don't know. I don't know how exactly we're going to solve this problem, but I want to get out there and I want to. And you know what I really like about our current Prime Minister is that I've noticed over the last 6 months of being in power as such, as our Prime Minister, he said, actually, I don't know. We have to think about this now.
Mm.
I don't know how to do this. Mm. Like, you know, I opened the newspaper this morning and I read it, the International Declaration for the Universal Elimination of Racial Discrimination. He said, I'm not doing it, or I want to do it, or we have a problem. He said, I don't really know how we're going to do this.
Right.
And I thought, dude, you're authentic. pretty cool.
Right.
I like actually listening. And there's a certain vulnerability. Now, coming out and saying, like, you
and
know, a lot of...
And that's strength.
It's a tremendous amount of strength. I can imagine our Prime Minister came out recently at a very large interview with international media, and he said, oh, when we actually wrote our manifesto, we didn't actually think we were going to win. So we put everything, you know, put our wish list and we put it out. Now that we are actually in charge of the place, hang on a minute, we have to think about what we can do, what we can't do.
Why didn't we say abolish GST?
Yeah, yeah. And it's really interesting. The whole country is in a quandary about this. People who are sycophantically following the Prime Minister will say, that's okay, that's okay. And people who are anti-Prime Minister will say, oh, you should have made this. You know, you can see all the opposition politicians, right? I have nine. Either a like or a dislike. I just go like, thank you. It's nice to actually hear someone not try and weasel their way out. Now, this is the real deal. I mean, researchers from Pepperdine University in California also published some really significant discourse in 2010 where they said that success comes for people who have authentic living. You know, and you actually live authentically, which means you're not lying to yourself, you're not lying to people, you're not covering stuff up all the time. And for that, it actually means acknowledging your fear as well, because, you know, your actual thoughts, your feelings, your desires all need to come in to play together. And that's what fear, acknowledging your fear, is part of that process of being authentic.
Right.
And that's what it does for people. And that's what I always remind people. Just be real. If you're afraid of something, say you're afraid of something and then work on it. Right. As opposed to ignoring it, sweeping it under the carpet, pretending it doesn't exist, but it looms really large in your life all the time. You just don't talk about it.
Mm. So how did, you know, back to your earlier comment and your reading Aristotle and all that, how does fear build courage?
What does fear do? Fear builds courage because fear captures your attention, Frida. Do you know what I mean? For me, it captures my attention. So the moment I think, it's like, I think it comes back to perhaps the way I was, you know, when I was a student before and when I was younger. I was a bit of a last minute merchant, which means, you know, a particular a dissertation or a report or a thesis at university. I studied law, so we had wrote a lot of stuff. We had to write a lot of stuff. So, like, you know, I'm given a deadline. 15th of December, for example, is a deadline. Or 15th of January is the deadline. So I'm told today, which is, you know, whatever the date is today, 18th, 19th, 17th. 15th of January, I've got to submit a report. And I go, like, I can do that. It's not a big deal. But I will revisit it only around the 13th of December.
Okay, all right.
Or the 10th of December, okay. Something along those lines. And
January, you mean?
Yeah, 10th of January. You're right. I'm even going backward right now.
10th December was giving you
already passed. Yeah, way too much time.
Yeah.
But I would revisit it, say, maybe 3, 4, 5 days. But the irony is I realized at one point in my life that it was not that I didn't think about it from the 17th of December until the 10th of January. Yes. I did think about it. Every time it came, I'd put it aside. So what fear did eventually to me was, it, you know, when I went into my, and I still remember it was my first year at university, and I was doing, we had to study contract law. And I had a really nice time because I had it at my first year at university because I had some really great teachers, and I was really astounded by the depth of their knowledge, also the engagement levels, which was very high in comparison to coming from a school and, you know, in Malaysia. I found at that time in the 1980s, the teachers there were much more engaging. I'm not sure what they're like right now. But what happened to me was I walked in, I thought, fantastic. Teachers were nice. They were on a first name basis with the students. So we didn't call, I didn't call my lecturers, sir. They wanted me to call them Richard and so and so and so and so. Like, yeah, this is all very nice, right? And then I walked into my contract class. I mean, this giant of a woman. I mean, she was a very large woman, but large not just in terms of her physicality, but she had a booming voice. Her name was Meraldine, Professor Meraldine. And I still remember, I got really scared of her. And there was like legends that were floating in the law department about urban legends about not messing around with her. And she would take no prisoners. We had no compulsion going to lectures. Yeah, so we had to be compulsory was going to tutorials, but not lectures. So we had 69 people in my class, so you could just not show up at lectures. But she knew everyone who came and didn't come. She never took attendance, but she did a cursory glance every single lecture, noted down who was not there, and then in the tutorial, she'd pick on you to ask you questions, and then she would remind you that, well, of course, you didn't show up on Tuesday, you didn't show up last week on Thursday. And I'm like, how do you know I didn't show up? Like, there's 69 people. And then she'll go like, I know exactly who's there and who isn't. And she would pick on you every time you were not there.
Okay. Okay.
Now, this built a tremendous amount of fear in me going to her class. But I eventually got the highest score for my contract law. When I came out to practice, I was most interested, or rather, that's the only thing I remembered. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because this fear that she instilled in me at that beginning stages, and what fear does, I think fear captures your attention. So what does it do for you? It actually captures your attention. Yep. When you are fearful of something, you actually, you know, go like, okay, so that's something I need to concentrate on.
Right.
Weight is the same thing with me, you know. Like, okay. I've struggled with my weight for many, many years, and I've reached a point where now, actually jumping on a scale every morning is something I now practice. Mm. I need to get on a scale every morning, because when I get on the scale and I see 83, I go like, oh, today I need an apple day, or today I need to do something about this today. Today we go completely commando. Not the way you're thinking right now, but, you know, like not eating anything else, but only eating the right thing. And what that scale does for me every morning right now. So if I'm hitting, you know, like this morning I got up, I was like 81.8. I'm like, yeah, nice. This is a good day, baby. Do you know what I mean? That's what it is. So when it hits 82, I'm going like, okay, 82. Deepavali last week, you know, after Deepavali, I was like 82.5. I'm like, okay, macho, calm down, cut down the mutton, you know what I mean?
So Tisha, because Christmas is coming.
Well, because Christmas is coming, a holiday season's coming, and I'm traveling here. Oh no. So now I just need to find a little pocket scale I can take with me when I'm traveling and stuff like that, so I can just, you know, hang myself on it to figure out my weight, just like a bag scale. But what fear does is fear actually gets you to concentrate on things, which otherwise you won't.
Mm.
And this week, getting up and going on the scale. Now, irony of it is, before I didn't like to get on. I always had a scale. My wife and I have a weighing machine in the bathroom. It's there still, but for years I never got on it because it was debilitating. Because every time I got on and I saw 90, 91, and I used to be 96 kg at one point. No, I mean, I'm a year and a half ago.
Seriously?
I was 96 kg. Now I'm 81, 15 kgs less. 96 kgs when I step on, I don't want to know, la. The macha inside me is going like, why you want to know? You know already what you're fatty. You know, just go and eat, brother. Go and eat. Enjoy yourself and eat. You know, so that's essentially what I'm saying.
Okay, we'll talk about your experiences with fear in your ventures in just a moment. I'm here with Shankar Santiram from EQTD Consulting. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Bending fickle minds. BFM 89.9.
Shankar Santiram from EQTD Consulting, still here for Raise Your Game here. It's a developing a personal growth culture, and we're talking about what fear does to us. You know, earlier on, Shankar, you were sharing about what fear does to people and how also fear can help build courage, right? I just wanted to talk about something as well. Many years ago, I read this book, and it was really mind, expanding for me. And it was by this lady called Tara Moore. It's Playing Big. Mm-hmm. And the Hebrew language has two words, Peshat and Yira. I'm sure I got one of the pronunciation because it's Hebrew. Peshat and Yira. And when one of the fear, I can't remember which one, is the reptilian fear. Uh-huh. So it's like, better don't do this or you will fall off the cliff. Yeah. That kind of fear, right? Yeah. So the reptilian fear. The other fear was the one that scares you, mm-hmm. but it makes you become a bigger person. Yeah. And that's the kind of fear. So whenever something like that is, you know, facing, so is this the fear that will kill me, mm-hmm. or is this a fear that will make me a bigger person?
Yeah.
Not figuratively, not literally, figuratively.
Figuratively. And I think that's a you know, the trick I would imagine is to know the difference between the two, to have the wisdom to discern which one is which. And we all have that reptilian fear. And that reptilian fear comes from our limbic brain,
right.
Which is what, you know, the psychiatrist and I were talking about some time ago. Mm-hmm. But even the limbic brain manifests stuff that the neocortex puts in. So your conscious mind plants stuff into your subconscious mind, and then that becomes like, oh my God, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of debilitating behavior that people have, I'm told by people in who are experts, subject matter experts, I'm told that a lot of debilitating fears that people have is essentially because of stuff that's been planted in, that they themselves plant in themselves.
Mm.
So what I think we need to understand is a lot of our debilitating and limiting behavior comes from our inability to access that part of the brain that releases that fear.
Mm.
And as a practice, If you get inspired enough to confront your fears, then that acts or goes a far way towards redacting some of that limiting behavior. Then you might actually end up finding that your that reptilian fear reduces down tremendously.
You know, one of the things that even maybe every year I'll do something that frightens me.
Absolutely.
Because it's just a way of growth.
Yeah.
Right? Builds courage, builds confidence, you know.
And also I think to have that knowledge that there are certain things that I won't do, and yes, I am afraid of it, and you know what? It's perfectly fine. Mm. I was in Tairi Gorge in New Zealand some years ago, and everyone was jumping off and doing bungee jumping, and I thought, you know what? I got to confront my fear. Mm. I got up to the top and thought, no, I don't want to confront my fear. And I came down, people were laughing at me, and I went like, yeah, I'm the bus. I'm the guy. I am that guy. You know, and then I was with some people and they said, like, oh, really, are you not ashamed? I said, no. I know that this is just going to, you know, do my head in. I'm scared. I really am scared. You know, and I really don't feel the need to
prove anything.
And I was completely fine. And I was, you know, driving off to the next town and I said, perfectly fine. I was going to Queenstown or something in New Zealand. And I got there and I was with a group of people and they were like, oh, you know, everyone was boasting about it. And there wasn't even a moment of time in that group of friends that I was with when they were boasting about the fact that they were doing it and how amazing it was, and it's like a life-changing experience. Not an iota of me felt that, oh, I should have done it. I should have overcome my fear. I just went like, idiot. You know what I mean?
Not on my bucket list.
Absolutely.
You and me.
Thank you. As I'm not the only one. So it's interesting to know, for me to know for myself that the real problem is when I beat myself up about it.
Mm.
And that's what that experiential learning has taught me, that there are certain things that I'm afraid of that drive the fear of the sweet Lord into me.
Yeah.
But I accept that that is something that I'm fearful of, and I acknowledge it and I'm authentic about it.
Right.
To myself.
Yeah.
I am afraid of that. I won't do that. You know
that thing when I talk about the bucket list and what I would regret, right? I know that I will have no regrets not having bungee jumped.
Absolutely.
I would have regretted not finishing a full marathon.
Absolutely.
And that's why I did it, right? And that was
and,
like...
And knowing the difference.
Yeah.
You know? Right. Actually knowing the difference.
So do tell us, you know, any ventures that you're involved in and you've experienced fear.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I'm a firm believer that if anything you start must both excite you tremendously and scare you as well at the same time. And I think then it's a big enough goal. And I think Bob Proctor, management expert, long-time, you know, motivator, management guru, talked about this, that your goals must both excite and fear you. So yes, a lot of the things that I do, I get a bit afraid. Like, for example, I am co-owner of Malaysia's only stand-up comedy club, The Crack House. And that frightens me. Not frightens me from a business perspective, but the irony is I speak for a living, you know, right. So which basically means I run training programs with a large group of the largest training program I ran with is 15,000 people in a stadium. So I get a call from my partner, Rizal Van Gezel, who is the director responsible for operations. And he goes like, hey, you know what? I'm headlining this week and I can't find, if there's multiple things going on, it's a Friday or Friday night, are you available? I'm thinking like he wants me to come and watch because he's headlining the club. And I'm like, yeah, I'm available. And he goes like, I need a favor. Can you host the show?
I say I was available?
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, no, I can't lie. I understand that he doesn't want to go out and hire someone different and pay them lots of money and they can do it with me. But I can tell you that of all the things that I do in terms of standing in front of a group of people, the stand-up comedy stuff, which I am not an expert at by no stretch of the imagination, I have zero material. People say, oh, you're very funny when you're wearing the train book. Yeah, that's because, you know, I just make silly comments. But stand-up comedy requires you to sit and write material and be proficient in delivering that material. And the result is immediate, yeah? So people, you stand, you're absolutely naked. There's nothing between you and the audience. And if you've ever been to my club, the Crack House Comedy Club, we are like, you're like, you know, a whisker away from the first customer. And you get feedback right away. People either boo you or laugh at you, clap or sympathize. And I've done this, and I remember the first time I did, the first time I was asked, I mean, years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, it's 4 years ago when we started, I went up and said, yeah, no, absolutely, no problem. What I do this for a living. Speaking is not a problem. Ask me, I can never be quiet in BFM. You know what I mean? The shows go too long because I'm on. I can speak, right? Now I stand up there and I freeze and they go like, oh my God. That's the kind of noises I was actually making on stage. And then my partner is like, "Macha, not that easy. Eh? Mm. This is not that easy. Eh? It's very different, isn't it, from what you do?" And now when he tells me, "Can you host the show?" I go into a massive deal. But you know what it does for me? I know my work as a trainer. And I have a suite of 15 programs that I run. And I can pretty much walk into any group of managers, senior managers, directors of companies, stand in there and just start a program. I do get the adrenaline pumping, so I get a bit nervous, but I can turn up and I can do it. I don't actually need to do much research now because I have my slides, you know, I have my material. I walk in and I do it. When I do a hosting job at the comedy club, I spent days before kind of, you know, having palpitations and sheets of paper around me, writing notes for myself, getting it ready, memorizing stuff and showing up. And when you host a show, you're standing in the front for like 3 minutes before you introduce the first act. And, you know, my wife will always go, "Why do you do this and torture yourself?" I become irritable in some ways. And after a while, I thought, "I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. I'm never going to get on stage at the club. This is ridiculous, you know." And then I told myself one day, "You speak for a living. This is what you do. And this is just another iteration of what you do. And for this, you find it so tough. You cannot be this way." And then I realized that I had to prepare.
Right.
I literally had to prepare for this. Mm. You know, of course, we're a club, so there's some alcohol about sometimes, and maybe that helps a little bit to Dutch courage, as they call it. But then I also realized that this is why a lot of stand-up comedians have major issues. You know, they abuse a lot, they have a lot of personal abuses in terms of body abuse because they get scared and get nervous. And I thought, well, no, I need to go on stage and I need to do this. And then I challenged myself to do it a few times. I mean, I still frighten myself senseless before I get on, but it's not as bad as before.
Go on.
So what personal experience it taught me was that, you know, I really didn't want to do it, but I did it. I still get afraid when I do it, but I'm no longer upset with myself that I'm afraid.
Mm.
What I do feel right now is I know I'm going to be afraid. So what I need to do, I can't just waltz in and take the stage. I need to be prepared. So I've been asked to do sometimes. So now the only thing I do at the club without any preparation is the guy, the voice behind that you can't hear, you know, "Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Resolve and Gazel, your host." You know, I do that because I no need for practice. I mean, I can stand behind a dark corner and do that. Nobody's actually saying anything to me. People just give me a thunderous round of applause. The announcer, you know. And I realized that all I need to do is prepare. If I prepare, it doesn't stop me from being afraid, but it allows me to overcome.
And I guess it's a new skill. Now you can go into the room full of CEOs and start with a joke.
I could. I try not to, but I could.
So what's your takeaway on this lesson?
Fear will never go. Embrace fear. Learn to manage it. Know that fear will either debilitate you or motivate you. Always choose to allow it to motivate you, because when it debilitates you, that is a knock-on effect on many other parts of your life and pretty bad. Don't do it.
On that note, he'll be back for the third Monday of next month, for the last one for
Thank
the year.
Frida.
Developing a personal growth culture series. I wonder what he'll talk about. Shankar Santar from EQTD Consulting. This is Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.